Welcome to the podcast, where we challenge conventional thinking and explore fresh, forward-looking perspectives on leadership. Whether you're a seasoned executive or an aspiring leader, join us on a journey to uncover the complexities of modern leadership. Because leadership itself may not change, but the way we think about it is constantly evolving. This is Rethinking Leadership, a podcast by T. Yas Business School, hosted by Executive Professor Rumer Visser.
Today, my guest is Dr. Amy Edmondson. She's the Novartis Professor of Leadership and Management at Harvard Business School. She's the author of seven books, including The Right Kind of Wrong, which was published just a year and a half or so ago in 2023. And of course, The Fearless Organization, which was published a couple of years before that. Many articles published in top journals and more accolades and recognition than most athletes have medals. Amy, it is a real pleasure and privilege to have you on the podcast. Thank you for joining.
Thanks for having me.
You're great. Absolute pleasure. So maybe I can begin with kind of a bigger picture question. Obviously, your main mark, if you will, is psychological safety. That's what most people know you from. But you make a kind of a bigger argument about the kind of leadership that is needed to meet today's and tomorrow's challenges in a complex, interdependent world where judgment and collaboration is necessary. So I was wondering if we can start with that. What shift is needed in our leadership, generally speaking, in the organizational context, to be able to meet and address these challenges?
Yeah. It's, the shift that's needed truly, in my view, can't be overstated. It's kind of night and day. It's, the taken for granted mental models that many leaders grew up with, just don't work in a highly uncertain context. And that's the one we're now in.
Right? Yeah.
So if you have high uncertainty, oh, and by the way, a great deal of interdependence, where mm-hmm. people and parts need to be working together for outcomes to be achieved. That's just not a world that conforms well to set the targets. Here are the answers. Here are the plans. Here's the tasks as they should be done the right way. Right. All of those classic mindsets and skills of management, the ability to evaluate, I can evaluate you. Did you do it right or not right? Right. Those in a sense have to go out the window and be replaced with something a lot more like a scientific mindset, right? Where I don't bring the answers as a leader. I bring questions. I maybe set direction. I maybe suggest some things to try. I help make sense of confusing data. We celebrate progress and discovery rather than accurate completion. It's just a really, it's a different game. It's the game of discovery, no less interested in speed and, effort and all of that. But we now live in a world where we cannot take as a given that we know the right way to achieve the results that we're trying to achieve.
Yeah. So I think if I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying, an effective leader in this new interdependent context really sets a context where he or she can tap into the wisdom of the collective.
Right. Absolutely. And tap into it in a way that the leader's helping them tap into each other's wisdom as well. So it's not a hub and spoke idea. It's a creating the conditions whereby team learning and team wisdom can happen.
So what then, to kind of maybe drive that point home, what should leaders stop doing? You've kind of already alluded to it,
yeah.
But maybe we can drive it home a little bit.
I mean, I think we have to stop rewarding announcing in advance that we will be rewarding, hitting your targets, for example. That's one of the simplest things. You say, well, what are you talking about, Amy? Of course we want to reward that. Well, the problem is what that primarily rewards is the behavior of setting the targets too low. It's setting the targets at a level that, you know, even in these crazy uncertain times, you know you can reach them. And that's not what you're looking for. You know, you're looking for stretching, learning, trying, going for it, sharing, and feedback, right? So you have to stop putting yourself out as a sort of model of the person with the answers and start getting in the habit of asking really good questions, well-phrased questions. You have to stop thinking you can, you know, find and punish the culprits, and instead be looking for the treasures and the ideas and people willing to speak up when they see something wrong.
Yeah. And it's, of course, it's hard to disagree with. And I should say also for the audience, just so that they know, I'm a big fan of your work. I use it all the time. So I'm not at all in disagreement with you. But I do want to sort of channel the devil's advocate here.
Great.
You know, you might have a CEO of a publicly listed company who says, you know, that sounds nice, but I am under severe pressure to meet these short-term expectations. I need them to deliver the result.
Right.
I'm not going to deviate from that, and I'm around several organizations these days where that pressure is enormous.
Yeah, and I feel their pain, and I hear you, right? And yet, it turns out I don't have a magic wand. I will say,
really,
right? Because you know, if I did, by all means, I would give it to you. Like I would share it with you, right? And I would say, I see you're under pressure to deliver results. So, yes, oh please, then let's just go back to that, right? Because there's and I don't mean to be facetious or sarcastic, but the reality is, we want people leaning in, right? Working hard, trying hard, doing their very best to achieve those results. But we are at risk of them making it look like they achieved those results rather than actually achieving those results. When the message is loud and clear and the punishment, so to speak, for not reaching targets is loud and clear, people will find ways to make it look like they reach the targets, not because they're bad people, but because the incentives are just too strong, right? So you have to kind of say to these leaders, I hear you, and are you willing to trade honesty for, you know, the illusion? And I know you're not. Therefore, we're going to have to just declare the dilemma and do our best, right? So some results that we're under pressure to achieve are indeed achievable, right? Some aspects of any organization are in relatively familiar territory, where in fact we have a clear recipe for how to get that result. Let's work hard. Let's make those things happen. I call those the consistent contexts. But some contexts are relatively well understood, but bring in a whole lot of variability based on, you know, whether it's the weather or the customer arrival patterns or the supply chains or what have you. And those domains of variability, you just don't have a magic wand to wish them away. If you did, you would, right? Yeah. And so what you have to do is say, okay, here's the reality. We're going to make sense of the data as fast as we can. We're going to do our best to navigate that variability. And it won't be perfect. It won't be possible to get everything we want in the time we want it. And then there are contexts which are truly novel, R&D labs, and new markets, et cetera. And those are the ones where we must say the fact is we need to experiment. We need to try things that we hope will work. And we have good reason to believe they might work, but in fact they may not work, and that's okay too, right? Either source of feedback must be heard loud and clear so that we can use it and pivot appropriately. So it's so tempting to want everything to be back in that original context, you know, that old consistent context where all you had to do was double down on effort and hit the results you wanted. But you can't do that under conditions where that's simply, it's not about effort. Yeah. It's about ingenuity. It's about sometimes external forces outside your control.
Yeah. It sounds like there's an implicit call to, shall I say, courage for some of these CEOs as well. I mean, there's empathy and sympathy for the situation.
Courage.
But
yep. I mean, courage at all levels, right? Courage of the leader to say, yep, I can't promise those results. Courage of people at all levels to speak up honestly with the straight talk, not the happy talk.
Yeah.
So courage isn't, you know, the willingness to be brave, the willingness to, in both in the kinds of risks you take and in the speaking up risks, is part and parcel of excellence in today's world.
Yeah. Yeah. Got it. Thank you. So if indeed learning is kind of central here to performance, even yes. though the way we tend to frame it is as antithetical to performance, we're either
right.
performing or we're learning.
Right, right, right. And learning is time taken away from performance.
Yes.
It's that's right. I think that's the old mental model.
Yes.
And the new or, you know, updated mental model that we need to embrace is what I like to call execution as learning. Right. So it's both, right? The way you execute in an uncertain environment is as a learning process. It's kind of plan, do, check, act all yep. the way along. It's okay. Yep. Let's try this. If it works, great. Let's intensify it. If it doesn't, let's figure out why not quickly and let's pivot accordingly yep. with that valuable new knowledge. So, cause we don't have the choice to kind of, ooh, let's wait and develop the perfect plan, then we'll execute. That's where the pressure and the time frames and so on won't allow us to do it that way anymore.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
what we need to do instead is kind of learn in action, you know, learn while executing, which means that execution becomes a process not just of to spec, but of massive learning along the way.
Yeah. Are there any organizations that come to mind that are really doing this well in terms of sort of setting KPIs that reward, that measure and reward learning?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are quite a few. Maybe because I talked to someone from AWS recently, that just like last week, that comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
But Amazon Web Services, but they have built in systems and habits in that part of the organization to reward experimentation and reward the collection and sharing of data. And so at any given time, you know, a handful of things are happening that we don't know whether they'll work out as we hoped. Some years ago, I did a deep case study at Intermountain Healthcare in Salt Lake City and the surrounding areas. And they had mastered the art of execution as learning, where they built in a kind of learning and feedback process to every clinical process, right? So it was an idea of, yes, we today believe this is a pretty good way, maybe the best way of delivering this kind of care to this kind of patient. And we fully expect that by virtue of doing this today, we'll get a little bit smarter and codify that a little bit smarter into tomorrow's processes. So
okay.
It was quite deliberate and quite, you know, quite thoughtfully scaffolded and designed.
Okay.
And, you know, I think you can say the same for Pixar, uh-huh. Many, you know, a handful of companies that are just really good at what they do and realize that any success we have today is temporary at best. We
yeah.
need to be investing in deep learning processes and habits at all times.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. So thank you. So that's evidence right there that at least it's possible. And just because
yeah,
organizations
yeah. it's not natural.
Exactly. And just because they don't know how to measure it, how to turn it into sort of a management dashboard, how to adjust their mm-hmm. reward systems, doesn't mean it can't be done. It is being done.
Right. Right.
That's important to say.
It's very important to say,
yeah.
you know, and this isn't the first, I first thought about this when I saw a new technology rollout in a telecommunications company, a very large market. I won't name what it was, but it was just a colossal fiasco. It was a service fiasco. Right? Everybody was upset with the service. It was costly. It was embarrassing. It was, you know, it took a long time to dig out. And it really was, it was because of, you could trace it directly back to that mindset of, here's the design. Okay, now we execute.
Oh, yeah.
Versus realizing this thing was way too new and different, that the only way to execute was to execute as a learning process.
Yeah.
So I came up with that idea, and this was, 25 years ago. And then when I studied back in 2010, the Chilean mine rescue, which was an extraordinary, albeit virtual organization in a way, and that it was all these different people coming together. But it was an extraordinary case of literally no solution, uncertainty, new territory, impossible challenge technologically. And one of the best managed execution as learning processes I have ever seen. It's an extreme version of a mindset and a set of habits that others too can emulate in today's world.
Let's run with that example, because I'm really curious. We haven't touched yet on psychological safety, but we've talked about the importance of tapping into the knowledge of the crowd, collective wisdom, experimentation, nobody having a monopoly on the truth. And clearly, this concept of psychological safety is central to all of this. And by the way, for the listeners, you just mentioned Pixar. My good friend, a strategy professor, Philip Galdries, he says the book Creativity Inc. by Ed Catmull, he calls it required reading for every aspiring executive. And I read that book also voraciously, and I saw it as a huge testament to the importance of psychological safety, even though the term was never mentioned.
Right.
So, yeah, for the listener, if they're interested, pick up that book.
I couldn't agree more. It's a brilliant book. It's a brilliant book about leadership, organization, innovation, and indeed psychological safety. In fact, I love it when it's not mentioned. Psychological, because it's, it just shows, it doesn't have to be, it's worse when it's mentioned, but it's bunk, right? But when it's just built into the processes and the climate, and when there's a deep recognition as there is at Pixar, and it's really comes out in that book so beautifully, a deep recognition that we don't have the answers yet, right? Yeah. We're gonna have to create them. And by the way, it won't be me and it won't be you. It'll be us in some way, shape or form.
Yeah.
And in order for that to happen, we're going to have to do the hard thing of giving each other feedback on the evolving product. I'm going to have to point out the weaknesses in your work. Yeah. Ugh, there's nothing I like less, but I'm going to do that hard thing because of what's at stake.
Yeah, calling someone else's babies ugly is never easy.
Yeah.
Maybe we can go to the example of the miners in Chile, because you've studied that so closely. Do you have a sense of how psychological safety show up and what the people on site did or didn't do that allowed that safety to surface?
Yes, and let me be very specific here, or try to be clear, which is, for the moment, let's talk about the rescue operation, right? Which is sort of dozens of people, literally from all over the world, many from Chile, led by Andre Sugaret, fantastic sort of, innovation leader, execution as learning leader. And psychological safety is running through the whole story. But again, you don't need to, you won't see those words in the case study. You might see those words in some of my other writings about it. But how does that happen? Well, I think several really important and transferable ideas. One is leadership that says loud and clear and early and often, we don't have the answers, right? And we are committed to solving this problem. We're going to do it. We're not going to stop. We're going to do it. We're going to pull from the wisdom of everybody here. We're going to essentially try things and fail and try again and fail again. And with every failure, there will be learning, right? So it's really naming the kind of work this was. Mm-hmm. A leader, really a handful of leaders at all levels, who listened intently, like no idea was, or no person's idea was not worth listening to. The lowest technician, the highest, executive. Right. Sort of, listening intently. That doesn't mean, we stop on a dime and jump on every idea. No, you know, many of the ideas are crazy. There was one idea that was shared that had to do with, you know, astrology, and no, we don't, that wasn't going to be turning our operation around to do that. But a 23-year-old, in fact, did have an idea about a particular kind of drilling technology that was not from the mining industry, but from oil recovery. And Andre Sugrit listened intently to that young man's thought and said, that just might work. And then empowered him to go to the supplier, get the stuff, go experiment with it. Skip ahead. That idea, which was later called Plan B, saved the day.
Wow.
Right? So that's psychological safety, right? And that young man, when he, you know, his uncle said, well, go talk to Andre. He said, who, me? Right? I'm way down here. He's way up, you know, no. Said, no, you better go talk to him. So he did. Andre listened, right? That's incredible. I mean, not incredible. I mean, it should be the way it is, but it isn't always. So there was listening. There was clarity in setting the stage for the kind of uncertain, novel task it was. There was beautifully sort of structured experiments that made it easier for people to speak up with the bad news, which was mostly bad news. You know, most things didn't work. Enormous respect, teaming across disciplines, but I'd say it's really the setting the stage and then the deep listening, the asking good questions, the listening to the responses, empowering people to go try things that both manifests and creates, you know, it shows that there is psychological safety, but it also creates more psychological safety.
Yeah. Yeah. It becomes a virtuous circle. Cycle. Yeah. Okay. And for the very few listeners out there who don't know what psychological safety is or haven't read your work, can you give a brief recap of what it is and maybe more importantly, what it isn't?
Sure. Yeah. So it's, I describe it as a climate where you believe that you can speak up with ideas, questions, concerns, even mistakes, without fear of rejection or humiliation. Right? So probably more simply, I could say it's a sense of permission for candor. Now, notice I did not say, and I mean not to say, that it's easy.
Yeah.
It's not, this psychologically safe environment is not one where you feel like it's easy to offer a dissenting view or to ask for help or to admit a mistake. I don't think those things are ever easy.
Hmm.
But it is one where you believe it's what we do around here. Right?
Yeah.
It's welcome. It's expected.
It's almost an obligation, it sounds like.
Yeah. Almost. Yeah. It is that sort of obligation. It's in the obligation domain.
Yeah.
With a healthy dose of knowing you shouldn't be too afraid. You know, even though it feels awkward, you should not be afraid because honestly, your colleagues expect it. So it is not about being nice.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about feeling comfortable, you know, being wrapped in cotton wool. It's not a guarantee that all your ideas will prevail. You know, that if you speak up, suddenly the room will, you know, turn on a dime and follow your idea to the end of the earth. You know, and I only mention that because I've heard over the years people saying things like, well, I shared my idea and the boss didn't agree with it, so that took away my psychological safety. It's like, no, please, no.
Thank you. Thank you. I hear that all the time, too. And I'm like, no.
No, it's about learning, you know.
Yes.
In fact, you know, it's about the environment where we can have a really good debate, you know, where conflict can happen so that we can all get to a better solution than the different viewpoints we all each had individually coming in.
Yeah.
It's not job security, right? So there was a whole sort of layoff some years back at Google, and some guy stood up in the town hall and said, you know, you said you care about psychological safety, but now you've had these layoffs, so we don't have psychological safety. And I'm thinking, I read about it. I wasn't there, but I read about it and thought, well, you sure do. You know, you just stood up in a town hall with the top brass and everybody else and spoke your mind. That's psychological safety, right? It's not you know, freedom from layoffs, unfortunately.
Yeah, so that's a really important one, right? And you really are clear about this in your book, The Fearless Organization, that this is about an interpersonal fear. This is not right. about a fear of consequences, fear of critical yes. feedback, fear of loss of a job.
Yes, that's really important, right? Because yes. it's you know, it's oh, in fact, during COVID, I the book was written before then, but I was sort of saying, yeah, you know, it's okay to be afraid of the virus. It's okay to be afraid of, you know, a deadline. It's not okay to be afraid of each other because we need each other.
That's
right?
it. That's
to do
it.
A good job.
So psychologically safe does not mean everything is hunky-dory. And
no.
Exactly.
No.
And,
yeah.
And what I come across is some, I have heard some people say, well, I think we've overdone it on psychological safety. And intuitively it makes sense that you think, well, yeah. there's some kind of optimum.
Like, it's like we went too far
yes.
in that direction. And yet I don't see it that way, but it is, I do appreciate that it's a sort of a technical term for me. I mean, I don't think we went too far because I don't think there is ever a useful amount of interpersonal fear.
Hmm.
Right? There's certainly a useful amount of interpersonal respect and tact and skill, but not fear. And so I think when people say we went too far, what they mean is we went into the coddling territory.
Yes.
And coddling is not actually what we should be doing at work.
No.
And I could not agree more.
Yeah. And to me, it tells me you're not having the conversation you should be having.
Right.
So therefore, right. there's evidence of lack of safety.
Yeah. And the reason why this all is so important in the first place is that we human beings have a natural and then highly socialized tendency to self-protect, right? So if my primary goal, you know, even unconsciously, is self-protection, I want to look good, I want to come out all right on top, etc., then I will naturally, often without even thinking about it, hold back on the substance. I won't take risks. I won't share what I'm really thinking. I won't criticize your idea, right? Because it's so much more important to me to take care of myself, you know, to self-protect than to ensure that the team does well. Now, consciously, most of us would not see ourselves that way, but sort of unconsciously, if you will, that programming that leads us to self-protect above all else is not actually what we want. And it's not actually a very joyful experience either.
Yeah.
Right. It's kind of like a small win. You know, okay, I stayed safe today.
Yeah.
Well, what I'd really like is to take some risks today and then to emerge victorious on the other side.
Yeah. Clear. Thank you for clearing that up. I have a little bit of a nerdy question. One, it's maybe a small thing, but it's one I've been grappling with. So you say psychological safety is a belief that you won't be punished for making mistakes or silly questions.
Yeah.
And to me, a belief resides in individual people's minds.
Yeah.
And then you say, but psychological safety really exists at the level of climate. So
yes.
in this hypothetical situation, you have five people working together, four people say on their psychological safety questionnaire, top marks.
Yeah.
And one person says, I don't feel safe speaking up at all.
Right.
That to me creates kind of a conflict. Is it safe or is it
right.
not safe?
You're right. And I guess I'd have to say it isn't. It certainly isn't for that person. And I'll first say, because I think it's a really great question. I'll first say that, by and large in the data, that doesn't happen very often, right? So I'm not saying it can't happen. Of course it can. And in fact, it does. And there are reasons why it can happen. Variety of reasons that we could dig into if you want. But by and large, just as a statistical sort of pattern, what we generally see in the scores is greater differences between groups than within groups.
Yeah.
So, you know, within groups, because we've been working together for when we've sort of sized up the way it is around here in this group, you know, but many teams, you know, especially today, many teams come together for a very short time. So we might be sizing it up slightly differently. And in which case we probably don't have, you know, that variance itself is an index of it brings the psychological safety down a notch because yeah. at least one important person
exactly.
who
okay.
believes they can't, you know, they can't participate. Now, ideally somehow this would become known and we'd sort it and
yeah.
we'd, you know,
yeah.
we'd think, oh no, yeah. look, hey, this is really promised. Nothing bad happens to you here when you speak the truth.
Got it.
We love it.
Got it. Yeah. And my guess, I mean, I know this is hypothetical, is that this would probably be a reflection of either some personal baggage or expectation or pain that the person is bringing to the workplace, or one other person that they really can't really work with
yes.
pushing their
yeah.
buttons.
Yeah.
That's bringing
exactly.
the whole thing down. And I think it makes sense to say, let's park that, because
right.
not every threat, to your, sense of safety is going to be lack of psychological safety.
That's right. That's right.
And
people have different threat tolerance levels
yeah.
and
yeah.
different personalities and different prior experiences. You know, the biggest challenge, I think, with speaking up at work is the asymmetry, right? If I do it 10 times and you look interested and appreciative, that's great. You know, I'm going to keep on going.
Yeah.
But then one time, you know, you bite my head off. I might be a little risk averse now for the, so there's this profound asymmetry, you know,
yeah.
one more good experience, doesn't like wildly raise me up to new levels. But one really bad experience and it sends me, into the basement. So,
yeah.
So what do you do about that? I mean, I think we have to be very aware of that as leaders and as team members, just very aware of that asymmetry and realize that bad is stronger than good.
Yeah.
So in a way we have to go out of our way to listen, you know, to be respectful, appreciative,
yeah.
the same way we would want others to be with us.
Yeah. And that's, again, I'm not selling Ed Catmull's book here. But in that book, he really also describes something very similar. It's almost like there's the default is in the opposite
yeah.
direction.
Right.
There's almost a gravitational
yeah.
pull
oh,
towards.
Yes.
Yes. And it takes
yes.
constant effort to overcome that.
Yeah. In fact, recently I've started in talks in classrooms, I've started saying, you know, because people, I realize that people think, oh, you know, especially in this day and age, if we have low psychological safety, we're broken. It's shameful. No, no, no. Don't worry. Low psychological safety is the default, right? It's because
yeah.
self-protection is the norm. So you should expect that there's low psychological safety. And by the way, you should expect that you can flip it in a minute by simply doing what you're doing right here with me, which is when you ask a question, it becomes very awkward to not respond. Right? So you're automatically creating psychological safety for me to open my mouth. Right?
Yeah.
Right. And in fact, you're creating, you know, pressure for me to do so, because really it would just be so awkward to just sit here saying nothing.
Yeah. Well, while I still have you, I'll continue this pressure campaign. There's one case that came to mind, and admittedly, I only have one side of the story. This is a male supervisor holding a female employee to account on something that clearly had not been accomplished.
Yep. Right.
And
right.
her response was, "You are now making me feel totally unsafe." And it shut down the conversation. He was really frustrated about that encounter because
he should be.
He realized she drew a line that he couldn't cross. But what would you say to him?
Well, first of all, it happens all the time. You're not alone. And it happens for two reasons. One is the misconceptions people have about psychological safety. I mean, it's frustrating to me that someone, I mean, it's one thing to be upset that you got the feedback, but it's another to bring psychological safety into it, right?
Yeah.
I almost take that personally, but hey, I know what's happening,
yeah.
right? So one contributor to that breakdown was the misconception about psychological safety, which, by the way, I'm trying to address. And then the other is perhaps, and so he has to look at himself for a little bit of it,
mm-hmm.
which is the skill with which the feedback, you know, you said he had to call her to account. Well, you know, there are more productive, meaning more effective and less effective ways to give people the feedback that they missed the mark.
Yeah. Right?
And most of us, myself included, are not really good at this, right? This is a sport that very few of us reach the kind of, you know, elite athlete level. And so it's natural and normal for people to be defensive, to have trouble hearing it.
Yeah.
And there's a whole bunch of really good and, you know, practical advice on how do you do this well, and then, and how do you do it well such that you make it, you're sharing your observations in as concrete, not abstract, a way as possible, with fundamentally a forward-facing bent. Yeah. Like you're sharing it not to, I judge you as inadequate. Yeah. Nobody wants to hear that.
No.
No one will even at some level, you know, hear it or accept it.
Yeah.
It's so what you need to be sort of delivering the concrete as concretely as possible, the concrete feedback, you know, with specific observations. This happened, that happened, what have you. I inferred X, Y, Z. I'd love to get your perspective on it. What were you trying to do so I can help going forward to be even more effective or to be more effective?
Yeah.
Because in this case, even wouldn't work, right? So it's about knowing that at least in part, you know, his ability to deliver the message he wanted to deliver skillfully may still have opportunities to improve. But when someone says, you know, that, I would sort of push back and say, well, it's, I am so sorry. And I imagine this message is quite hard to hear. I do think it's a separate thing from psychological safety, which is about, you know, speaking up candidly. And I'm trying to do it, and I'm probably not doing my very best. But here, let's take a look at the strategies you used and the results they achieved, and see whether we can come up with some better strategies going forward. I have some ideas, but I'd love to get your ideas as well.
Very nice. You're doing live what we talked about earlier, is you're turning a performance challenge into a learning challenge.
Right. And forward facing rather than backward facing.
And it's
nobody, you know, like your spouse or whatever, nobody wants to hear, well, you screwed that up. And now it's like, I can't undo it. You know, it's done. I can't undo it.
Yeah.
But if we're inherently, you know, if we're trying to go forward, okay, you know, I do, in fact, want to go forward better.
So I'm hearing, you know, deliver it with care, hard on the issues, soft on the people. That's the way to keep it safe, but don't let yourself be distracted by somebody you know, saying, oh, I'm no longer psychologically unfit.
Yeah, because that's a red herring. Yeah. It's not an accurate depiction of the concept, but you can own your own, you know, skill deficits in terms of getting the message across in a way that's as helpful as possible to her. Because that, after all, is your job, is to help her.
Yeah, and it sounds like you're saying your job is to role model the behavior you're asking of your employees.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, yeah. Great. I was wondering if we can go back to kind of the work unit as the best unit of analysis for psychological safety.
Yeah.
You say that safety scores vary fairly significantly within organizations, but they tend to be most stable within work units.
Yeah, or at least more consistent within than between.
Yeah. I'm hearing kind of an echo of Gallup that found with their engagement scores, you know, supervisors account for about 70% of the variance. So by far the biggest impact. Is this also,
true
for psychological safety?
In fact, it's one of the reasons or one of the factors that explain why teams differ, because leaders differ.
Yeah.
So it's not just, I think it's partly an emergent property of the group, but it's partly skill of the leader or effectiveness of the leader. Right. So probably the biggest, not in all cases, but probably the biggest determinant of the psychological safety is the middle manager, the team leader, you know, the proximal manager.
So then, not to want to overcomplicate things, but wouldn't you then say that work units where engagement scores are very high, psychological safety is naturally going to be high as well?
Generally, yeah. Because I think people are more engaged when they're less worried about self-protection.
Exactly. So are they, to what extent is there overlap between the two, do you think?
Oh, I think it's very high. I have a few data sets where, you know, I forget. the correlation is high and strong.
Okay. Okay.
And I have my former student Michaela Carasi, professor at the Chan School at Harvard, has some couple of really good studies on higher psychological safety, lower burnout. So it's a kind of, you know, somewhat analogous.
So really, if organizations aren't in the habit yet of mapping and measuring psychological safety, but they've got a process in place of measuring engagement,
that's
a pretty good proxy for psychological
safety. Yeah, I think it's good enough. Because I, you know, I'm not, you know, a psychological safety purist. Actually, my pure interest, you know, my deep interest is in learning and the idea that today's organizations need to be learning organizations if they're going to survive in a changing world. And what does that really mean? Well, actually, that means they need to be populated with learning teams. Organization is an abstraction, but a team is a reality. You know, we're an R&D team. We're the senior management team. We're a, you know, assembly team. Whatever team we are, we got to be the best learning team we can be. And psychological safety is part of that. But psychological safety isn't the goal, right? Psychological safety is a kind of describes a climate where learning can take hold.
Yeah. You know, it's really refreshing to hear you say psychological safety is not the goal. And in your book, you offer a really nice analogy with brakes in the car versus fuel. You know, there's so much emphasis at these. It's so popular that sometimes I worry that it's going to collapse a little bit under its own buckle under its own popularity, because I'm seeing psychological safety showing up in mission statements. As if it's the panacea.
In fact, I can't tell you, you know, I get calls and, you know, reach outs about like, our goal this year is psychological safety. I just, no, it isn't. Right? Please don't have that be your goal. Tell me what your goal really is. You know, is it innovation? Is it, you know, customer delight? And I'll certainly reinforce the idea that psychological safety is on the path toward that goal. But if you make it the goal, I think people will shrug their shoulders, or they will not find that a compelling goal, nor should they.
And I love the analogy of, you know, lack of psychological safety. It's like the parking brake being on.
Right. So and that's the other thing. I think it's the analogy is, I mean to say that psychological safety is not the fuel that allows the car to go forward.
Exactly.
You know, that's gas or electricity or whatever it is, right? It's that you've released the brakes.
Yeah, it's an enabler.
It's an enabler, and you need to release the brakes, right? Because people put a lot of brakes on.
Oh, yes.
Because of fear and, you know, absolutely. I don't want to be wrong and I don't want to look bad.
But removing fear is no substitute for, you know, getting the car on the road, the fuel, the direction, the strategy, the mission.
You're going to have to figure out what the fuel is, and that's, of course, motivation, but also where the road is going. You know, there's a lot of things you have to figure out, and then the chances are you want people's foot off the brakes once you figure those things out, or as you figure them out.
Yeah. Okay. You talk in the book, Fearless Organization, a lot about, you know, fear. There's a section on, you know, is fear a good motivator, yes or no?
Yes.
And your argument is actually no, people don't learn when they're afraid, right? We know this from our neuroscience.
Yeah, the brain constricts, you know, the problem-solving ability is reduced, and our hiding from each other goes up. And, you know, that's the thing. And our tasks today, our work today is so... much of it, not all of it, but much of it's so interdependent that, you know, fear can really get in the way of excellence.
And still, I hear people say, but for innovation, you know, starvation breeds innovation. You need deadlines. You need pressure to stimulate creativity. How do you reconcile those two?
Yeah. I mean, I think you need pressure of the kind that I think comes from really caring, caring about the goal, caring about each other, you know, caring about, hey, you know, you want to be part of the winning team. I mean, there's a whole lot of reasons why people get energized and put their heart and soul into the work that lies ahead. But I think fear is not a particularly good motivator, because it just gets you more focused on what you want not to happen than what you want to happen.
Yeah.
And that's a distraction from the ingenuity and the problem solving that is going to be necessary to achieve the goals, to innovate.
I'm kind of getting a distinction now between being hungry and being scared.
Yeah.
Those are two different things.
That's right. I mean, when you're hungry, you can go, you're going to go get something to eat.
We want the hunger. We want the pressure.
We want to win the championship.
Pressure.
But when you're afraid, you're going to play not to lose. You're going to be on the defensive side of things.
And
nobody ever won a championship through pure defense.
Yeah. Yeah. Very clear. I'm curious, what drove you to write your latest book, The Right Kind of Wrong?
I wrote it because, in a way, psychological safety is sort of, as we've been describing, describes a context in which innovation can happen, in which worker safety can happen, in which quality improvement can happen. But Right Kind of Wrong helps me dig into the experimentation strategies through which new knowledge, new practices, new processes are developed in an uncertain world. So it's a little bit more on the substance of action, good, bad, and ugly. Also, just for fun, it allowed me to reach beyond the company setting and incorporate stories from people's lives, including my own, but mostly other people's, right? So it's like this is a set of ideas that are important at work, important for leaders, and also in a way they're important to us in our lives.
Yeah. It sounds like you're really trying to reframe failure. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Yes. And, you know, I had a section on reframing failure in the Fearless Organization.
Yeah.
I had a section on reframing failure in teaming. Right? I wrote an article in Harvard Business Review called Strategies for Learning from Failure back in 2013. I mean, I've been I had those early studies in medical error. I mean, I've been thinking about failure for 30 years. And I did not believe there was a whole book in it. But there was. And I mean, I'm really glad because I was able to do it justice, like to do the topic justice, or to say, yeah, there are basic failures we should work hard to avoid. There are complex failures that are on the rise, and best practices can help us prevent and mitigate them.
Yeah.
And then there are the intelligent failures that we must roll up our sleeves and just get cracking. Like we want them.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't want them. We'd rather successes. But if you want to do anything in new territory, they're going to be part of the journey.
Yeah, and is the word failure even fit for purpose anymore in that context?
Maybe not, but, you know, so I thought about calling them, you know, mistakes, accidents, and discoveries.
Uh-huh.
But then I thought, no, you know, in fact, part of the program is we got to get a little more comfortable with the bad news, right?
Uh-huh.
If we just gloss, we can't use that word, right? Oh, it's you know, it's negative, and I'm, you know, first to feel that way. It's like, no, we got to toughen up and say, because a failure, which I define in the book as an undesired result, we shouldn't turn around and pretend, oh, yeah, we desired that. It's fine. It's a discovery. It's a stepping stone on the way to success. Yes, it is. And it was disappointing. You know, if you're a scientist in a lab and your hypothesis is not supported by the data, you're disappointed, and that's okay.
Yeah.
But you know that if you're going to succeed in your field, you're going to have lots of those. So you sort of train, you toughen up, you get failure muscles. And then the other thing about it that allowed me the opportunity to write about it, find stories and so on, allowed me also to think about the competencies that we need, you know, the self-awareness, the context awareness.
Yeah.
We talked about context before, consistent, variable, and novel. And then the sort of help people be a little bit more systems thinking, as we really need in today's world.
Great. Well, this is an invitation for people to pick up your latest book, The Right Kind of Wrong, lessons about failure in different kinds of failure and the kind of failure we don't want, the kind of failure we do want. It's a welcome contribution, and welcome nuance to the conversation on failure.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me in this episode. I really appreciate your time.
No, I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you.